This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about sex as a factor in mental health. This is a topic I've been wanting to cover for some time and have found, I think, the ideal guest for it in Elaine Miller. She's a vagina physio who also does stand-up comedy relating to her work, and that's how I found out about her as part of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. She does a show which is themed around sexual dysfunction and educating people on how common it is, how, as she describes it, common but not normal so many things are, and that the help is out there. Through her work, she does a lot of pelvic floor exercises and gives a lot of practical advice to people that are struggling with sexual function, whether that's just limited to things that are impacting on their sex lives or even areas of, like, incontinence, which are really common, particularly in women, and yet aren't really talked about. A lot of this, for me, there's a natural link back to mental health. If you're not feeling confident in your sex life, if you have medical concerns, whether they're mental or not, they can often affect your mental health. So to start off, I wanted to read a bit of an article I found from Here to Help. They're a Canadian mental health information service, and they've written quite extensively about sex and mental health, how they relate to each other. So I'll just read a section of their article, which is titled, "Sex is a Matter of Mind." We often think of sex as something our bodies are doing, but a lot of our sex life takes place in our brains. It's important to realise that for all genders, our thoughts and feelings play a vital role in getting us turned on and keeping us that way. Anxiety or depression can strongly affect arousal and can definitely ruin the mood sometimes. Anxiety and other related mental health struggles can make it hard to be relaxed enough to have or enjoy sex, overshadowing it with a host of worries or intrusive distractions. When we are very unwell and struggling just to function, sex is rarely the top of our mind. Also, substance use may put limitations or restrictions upon one's sexual interest. Some drugs can affect your brain in ways that make you feel less able to feel pleasure from sex for periods of time or after their use. So the article goes on and suggests so many more links, but I just wanted to pick out that brief section, which I thought was particularly good. For context, when they mention substances, they go on to clarify that that's talking about drug misuse and specifically addiction. However, that does definitely apply with medications you'll take for your mental health. For many of them, a side effect can be decreased libido and it can affect sexual performance. Is there anything you wanted to say about that article, Danielle?
Well, first of all, how cool is Elaine? Yes. I mean, is she like the coolest person in the world? The fact that she's like a vaginal physio.
Yeah, that's the technical term. Yeah. In her stand-up, she says, so I'm a fanny physio.
Yeah, I just love that. I love that that's her job. And she also works as a stand-up comedian around the same subject. I mean, you just hear and meet so many interesting people doing this job, don't you? Yeah. How cool is that?
Absolutely. And her show is really hilarious. Yeah. It's so well done. So it is 100% a comedy show, but I learned so much through it.
Yeah.
And I ended up going back. It's actually so research driven that it counts as development hours if you're a medical professional. So I went back.
CPD.
Yeah, it really does. So I went back with my aunt, who's a GP, and that's going to be one of her hours of clinical personal development. Yeah.
That's so cool. You must have felt educated by it, Bobby, because we don't need to go into detail about the discussion we had before we started recording today. But Bobby was schooling me on certain things that, you know, given that I'm a few years older than Bobby, you wouldn't necessarily have thought the conversation might have gone that way. And I'm a woman, but it did. And now I'm going away with my little notebook and my research in Google, and I'm going to research it all and come back and say, I was right, this is this. But yeah, really, really cool. But, you know, on a serious note, the impact of mental illness on sex is just huge.
Yeah. And this one, more than many of the factors in mental health we cover, really goes both ways.
Yeah.
That sex can really affect how you're feeling, how your mental health recovery is going, but equally, you know, mental illness can really affect your sex life as well. So they can be so intertwined, but it was quite a difficult one when preparing for this episode and talking to friends about it. Some of them didn't really get it when I brought it up as a theme, because there's not that one clear thing of this and therefore that.
Yeah.
But instead, it's an intermeshing of many smaller factors working together.
Yeah.
So in the episode, we did our best to kind of run through loads of different factors. And one of them that you've reminded me of was education around sexual health. That if you don't have the basic knowledge of what normal sexual function is, how are you going to know if something's wrong?
Yeah.
And particularly for women, there seems to be such a skewing of the focus being on reproduction, as opposed to, okay, what about your pleasure, problems that you can have physically after childbirth? So much of that is ignored because the focus is on the reproduction and the sex functionally.
Yeah.
And not emotionally.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it was only 6 years ago when a friend of mine had a really, really, really hard labour and came away from the hospital with kind of long-term changes that absolutely affected her sex life. That it was the first time for us as women, 30, late 20s, that we were like, oh my God, we've never actually thought about this, because we've all been quite, you know, sexually active, and in our 20s we've lived our lives, it's all been cool, no one's ever had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden now you've had your second child and you are in pain when you're having sex, and the emotional impact that that had on her. And for me, as a friend who can talk and hopefully try and support my friends in about everything, but we were just like, I don't even know what to say to you. Like, it must be like, it's like heartbreak. Like, I felt, you know, she's crying, that the pain that she's going through, am I never going to be able to have sex again? Am I then not a woman? I'm single, so I want to meet people. And every time I meet somebody, if there's a thought of, you know, sex down the line, I'm worried about it.
Yeah.
It hurts. Am I going to be like that anxiety that brought on her came as a shot out of the blue for us as a friendship group, in terms of now what? Like, obviously we'll get it sorted. And thankfully now she's like rocking and rolling, loving her sex life. But she went through a lot of, you know, hospital visits and getting it all sorted, because it was just awful. And it was more the thought of what it meant to her and her sexuality than actually probably some of the physical ailments that it brought along.
Absolutely. It's makes such a difference to people. And a lot of, I think, the lack of understanding is around people not knowing how common so many of these issues are. And that's a big part of Elaine's work, is educating people on just how common these issues can be.
Mm.
And in many cases, how solvable they are with the right support.
Mm.
Like, I have no doubt that she is inundated through her clinical practice because of her show. Because of course you're going to want to go to her. She seemingly has all the answers to problems that nobody else is even acknowledging exist.
Yeah.
Of course you feel safe with Elaine.
Yeah, absolutely.
So to highlight how common issues relating to sex can be, we've got a few stats. So first off, an obstetrics and gynecology study review was reported by the National Center for Biotechnology Information, which found sexual dysfunction was more common in women at 43% than in men at 31%. And I wanted to highlight that one, actually less so about the gender comparison, but more just to show how common this is, that across a full range of adults, women is not far off half, and men is nearly a third.
Wow.
And yet, as much as I've had plenty of my friends talk to me about these kind of issues, and therefore I can believe it, I think a lot of people would be surprised by those stats.
Yeah, it's loads.
And even if you just think about it relating to a percentage comparison with mental health, how many conditions we talk about on the podcast where they have a 10% or a 5% or a 1% prevalence, and yet it can feel like they're everywhere, and these things are often just as common or more common, and are talked about even less. is a whole other area of stigma.
A whole other area of stigma. You're absolutely right. It's opened up the conversation, the research, the conversation we had before we started recording. It's just opened up a whole, there's a massive world out there to explore with this. It's huge. From young people and what they're going through, all the way up, men and women and everybody in between. It's just an absolute, and you're right, the mental illness side of it and the impact on relationships is just, especially if you've come from a really sexually active relationship and then all of a sudden you get unwell and you're diagnosed with a mental illness or not even diagnosed, but you're struggling and your sex, your libido just decreases.
Yeah.
How you feel about yourself, everything. And to try and talk that through with a partner or not and still try and do it but don't want to do it, whether then they start feeling rejected. You know, it really needs a relationship that's so open and free. You know, that ideal relationship where everybody can really communicate well to get through that. And even that, it's hard, let alone day-to-day relationships, especially where children are involved and working and busy lives. It's sad the impact that that lack of connection intimately can be compound your mental illness.
Yeah, because it's another worry you don't need. Absolutely. If you're already struggling with something, then you also need to navigate, okay, now my sex life has changed. Awesome. I don't want my partner to think they've done something wrong. Yeah. I want to try and live as normally as I can do, but my desires are different. And I don't feel emotionally invested in this as much as normal. It can be really complicated for people to navigate. And yet it's so common. The last stat I wanted to mention is from healing.com. And they reported that 63% of people who are medically treated with depression also suffer some kind of sexual dysfunction.
Yeah.
So that gives you an idea of how prevalent this is. And it really affects people. So it's even the things that we don't necessarily think of can still have a huge impact. And so I'm so glad to have talked about so many of these things in the interview. Just to finish off our intro on a more positive note, I did find something really lovely from the NHS, and in particular, they talked a bit about physical touch and how life-changing that can be for people. So I'll just read a little bit from that. The title of it is, A Hug Keeps Tension Away. Embracing someone special can lower blood pressure, according to researchers. In one experiment, couples who held each other's hands for 10 minutes, followed by a 20-second hug, had healthier reactions to subsequent stress, such as public speaking. Compared with couples who rested quietly without touching, the huggers had lower heart rate, lower blood pressure, smaller heart rate increases. So give your partner a hug. It may keep your blood pressure healthy.
Oh!
Isn't that so sweet?
That's lovely. It's a great way
and
to
it's
end.
Nice to see that the NHS, who are ultimately are, you know, our most clinical body in this country,
yeah,
are embracing each other, apparently.
Yeah.
And saying how there's all these factors that are less strictly scientific.
Yeah.
That there's scientific reasons behind it, but they're not going to prescribe a hug necessarily, but it's nice to know that there's understanding of how many factors can help.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, give a hug.
And I love the idea of GPs recommending, like, and do you hug your partner a lot? Maybe do that more. I think that's... That's a sweet idea, in addition to the other kind of support they're giving.
Yeah.
So we'll get into the episode with Elaine Miller in a moment. I'm really confident you guys are going to love her as much as I do. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. So the thing I wanted to start off with is kind of setting the scene for how sex is talked about or often not talked about appropriately in our society. So do you mind if we start off with young people and how kind of sex ed is talked and what you think is there that's good and what is maybe lacking?
That's great, yeah. It varies. I think there's not a basic standard. It's coming. It has to be part of the curriculum, but the detail doesn't seem to be particularly broken down. And when you've got areas that are particularly conservatively minded, or if you've got faith-based education, then that really skews the information that young people are getting. I think that it is worse than it was when I was a kid at school, which wasn't yesterday, because our young people are leaving school without really understanding what normal is. We didn't get that at school either. When did I leave school? 1989. It wasn't part of our education. But what I would like to see now is every young person leaves school knowing what normal peeing, normal pooing and normal sexual function are, so that they can understand what they can reasonably expect from their genitals. Mm-hmm. Because porn we're sort of outsourced education to porn, and it's totally counterproductive. And there's new sort of sexual disorders that are being seen that were really, really unusual, particularly amongst our young men. And that's got a definite link to their mental health and well-being. But we understand quite clearly that, you know, the suicide rate for young people is really startling. For men under 50, it's the biggest killer of that population.
It is, yeah. That's the stat from the BBC.
And we don't know, obviously, why these people are self-harming to that extent, because they don't leave information behind. So I'm quite interested to know if there's a link between sexual function and suicidal ideation in men, because a lot of blokes tend to conflate their value as a person with what their willy's doing. And if it's gone wonky, it really, really disrupts their sense of well-being to an extent I don't think we properly understand.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a disorder that's called hard flaccid syndrome, where the young guy, I mean, I can be pretty frank when
I'm
talking.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you're maturing, when you're becoming an adult, your brain is rewiring itself and laying down all these neural pathways. So if you're engineering your sexual response on what you see in porn, and you're masturbating quite vigorously with your little death grip, then when they're in a situation, an intimate situation with a person, they can't possibly replicate that sort of physical stimulation. So they can't get off. These guys can get an erection, but they can't orgasm, which is disturbing to them. And it quite quickly becomes quite a coercive situation because, well, they know they're all right, because when they're on their own, they can manage. It must be their partner's fault.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, well, if you would just do this, this and this, then I would be fine. The problem is you. So the dynamic is really fascinating to me, because these aren't people who are, you know, they're not predatory people, they're upset people because their body's not responding in the way that they expected. And if they knew what an erection is and how it works, then they would understand this is perhaps a problem and be able to seek help rather than just feeling distraught.
Yeah, absolutely. And you certainly reminded me of a lot of what I see with young people. I'm in the privileged position as someone who dates people of all genders, in that I can see it from both sides. And there is that kind of clear divide, which, as you say, a lot of it comes from education, where there's guys that are struggling to get it up or are struggling to reach climax from seemingly a far younger age than people have historically had problems with. Mm-hmm. That. And a lot of that is about porn. And so if they're used to a certain standard of visual stimuli, then it does put the pressure on their partner, because then it's like, oh, well, you're not being performative enough.
Yeah.
Only if you do these things differently the way I like. But actually, particularly young guys that are, you know, just learning about their own body and sex, mm-hmm. in general, they don't know what they like. Mm-hmm. They just know what they like to click on. And that's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've definitely been on the other side of that, where people have tried to blame me for them struggling to get it up. I'm like, that's between you and your dick, mate. And that's not the most sympathetic approach. I maybe wouldn't say that, but it is scary to me how it creates that kind of cause link.
Because you're a robust person now, so you're able to handle it in that way. The comment for that would mean that you're not going to take that personally. Whereas in a relationship, particularly with young people, because they're quite immature and they're still figuring, mm-hmm. all of these things out, it's really quite scary what happens to them.
Yeah, and maybe that's partly that I do know a bit more, that when I grew up, it wasn't just sex ed at school. You know, I did have chats with my parents, which not everyone gets. Mm. And there was things like the sex education show was on, and I watched that. And that's a show that's still available, I believe, on Channel 4 and is very open and frank. And so I kind of realised, actually, this stuff is quite interesting and it does apply to me and I'm not learning it at school. And so I guess I maybe sought out the information in a way that other people are doing through pornography. And so to me, I'm very much of the mentality of, if you're struggling to get hard, it's either something medical that's going on or something that is, in most cases, treatable, or it's just not the time. You know, maybe you're too nervous this evening and that's fine and you move on. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's why it's a bit easier for me. Whereas on the flip side, when it comes to female partners, it's a whole different set of issues to do with education, where they don't feel empowered often to ask for what they want. So you've got the guys that are like, no, I've seen this on a video. This is exactly what I want. You need to do this. And then on the flip side, the women don't know what they want because the female orgasm isn't taught.
No. And in school... So when you look at the first sort of lessons in sex ed, boys get taught about wet dreams, girls get taught about periods. There isn't really any education for young women about what they can reasonably expect from their body to do. And there's a whole lot of myths that were taught as well. So you're told, you know, the first time will probably hurt. Well, is that perhaps linked with why about 40% of women have pain and penetration? Because you're told it's going to hurt. Really, it shouldn't hurt. You know, if it's hurt, unless you really want it to hurt, in which case informed consent matters, it's quite important that you get that. There's an awful lot of women who live with deeply unsatisfactory sex lives because nobody has ever said to them, this is supposed to be fun.
Mm.
They're taught that it's a thing that you're supposed to, you know, submit to rather than do it because you have a whale of a time with somebody, and it's really sad.
Yeah. And nobody wins in that. If we at least just for now talk about heterosexual couples as an example, then it's putting the pressure all on the man of, you've got to make sure everyone in this situation has a good time, despite the fact that you're not taught about women's bodies, despite the fact there's quite a few things you don't know about your own.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're being fed all this false information from pornography. And there's even a funny bit in your show that you do, your stand-up show here at the Edinburgh Fringe, relating to your work, where you talk about men trying to treat the clitoris as if essentially it's the head of a penis, because they don't realize it's much more sensitive, so they're poking away at it, expecting the same kind of response they get with their own parts.
Yeah.
And so they don't win because they don't know what they're doing, and the women don't win because they don't know what to expect. It's, oh no, I'm going to lie back and it's all going to be done to me.
Yeah. And the clitoris is almost entirely absent from all history, like art history. It's not in cinema, it's not in porn, it's not mentioned. It's as if it's totally irrelevant, which, you know, most women would argue it's probably quite an important bit of your body, but it's not represented or regarded in anything apart from feminist literature.
Mm.
You don't see it in porn. Like, you know, it's not, female sexual pleasure isn't a feature in most porn. It's just, and even in research, the research into sexual function is almost entirely devoted to, can you get it in? So most of the focus is very phallocentric. The actual pleasure that the woman's supposed to be experiencing just seems to be irrelevant. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. The heteronormativity of all of the work into this is really depressing.
Yeah.
Mm. Apart from things like sexually transmitted diseases, but when it comes to actual sexual function, there's so much research into the willy because, as we know, it's very, very important. And whatever women has, it's a total mystery. There is some work that they did that they were trying to establish, like, what the female sexual response is. And they had a sort of probe that would measure blood flow. So they were showing women erotic images and then trying to see what she reported she found erotic, mm-hmm. compared to what her body was doing, how sexually aroused her body was behaving. And there was this difference between the two for quite a lot of the women, where they were watching things and like, no, that doesn't do it for me. But their fanny was going, oh, hello. And the women did not realise that at all. And they can't really release that information because what it's suggesting is that she's saying, no, this doesn't do it for me. They had to keep a diary, and a sort of like within a few hours to a few days later, she was absolutely gagging for it. So there's this sort of latent effect, but they don't want to put that information out into school children because she's saying no, but actually she's meaning yes. It's not the message that you want to give to young people. It's quite hard to communicate that in a way that they will, you know, interpret it in a mature, you know, they're just going to misinterpret it. It becomes a rapist's charter. It's not an ideal message to put out. It's so nuanced.
Yeah, and yet there's the solution is not to strip everything back to its bare bones. And I'm really glad to be partly covering this topic because at least in England and Wales, the reforms to what's known as PSHE currently in England, some people would know it as kind of form time, where you have lessons like sex ed, is changing. And we're part of that in terms of the mental health angle and getting mental health education in. And so there's loads of victories there. But one of my real concerns about it was seeing how sex education is handled, that in its most stripped down form, and certainly the version I was taught, it's very biological and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
So you see a diagram and you find out what all the parts are and their, you know, scientific names. And that's that. There's not a huge amount of, okay, but what do they do?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty sure I know where my penis is at any age. Boys don't tend to have a problem with that. And yet there's this really scientific approach because the science, I guess, feels safe to people. But then what it removes is talking about consent. It removes talking about safe sex, not just in terms of wear a condom. There's more to safety than just not having a wean. And I had similar concerns with mental health education. Is it just going to be, here's a list of conditions. We're not going to talk about what they feel like or what can cause them or self-care, because that's all potentially seen as a bit too non-scientific. And so we're just going to stick with talking about the brain and cortisol, and it's only part of the picture. And so one thing that's really good to see with the reforms in England and Wales is they're at the same time reforming sex ed and broadening it out. So for the first time, they're talking about what is and isn't an appropriate relationship, how your partner should be treating you as a person, not just where does this bit go?
Yeah.
And what kind of relationships are appropriate to have at different ages? Because otherwise it's not taught, you know. I grew up with Bart Simpson giving people moonies and I thought that was hilarious. And there was no one in school that was teaching me, okay, that's the parts that you don't show unless it's consensually and you're an adult. And it sounds like a silly example, but it's not being taught. And instead kids are learning from the media. Oh, this thing is funny. Oh, everyone on the TV is half naked. And seeing all these unrealistic sex scenes, like I think you said in your show, where a woman just goes, ah. And then that's her pleasure achieved.
Yeah.
As if she's just had a pleasant text.
That does it for me, actually, every time. It is difficult to make it age-appropriate because there's a conflict between the need to inform people with accurate information that will improve their well-being and their quality of life and this conflict with modesty. And especially when you're talking about young people, because there's such a variation in what parents are comfortable with their children knowing, then you're opening up a whole can of worms and you can really upset people. But I don't think that it's a problem to educate people and that for them to still choose to be modest or behave in a way that other people wouldn't behave out of, you know, their moral choices. Then education is always a good thing. And if you don't understand what your body is supposed to be doing and what normal is, then you can't recognise when things are going wrong. And especially when it's a sexual thing, because it makes you very vulnerable, then the self-blame and the feelings that that starts to generate can very, very quickly start to impact on people's relationships and their own mental health, their individual mental health. So we've got to talk about it more.
Yeah. And even I would add to that, I've known of plenty of situations with people around me where the lack of education has led them to, if we're talking about modesty, I guess, be immodest
mm-hmm.
as a way to learn.
Mm-hmm.
One example I'm thinking of in particular is a male friend of mine was experiencing premature ejaculation when interacting with himself at home and really didn't understand that because he was like, well, this shouldn't be this stimulating, it's just me. And so his plan for how to figure this out wasn't to go to a doctor, it was to get a girlfriend, because then he can sort of, in a cringy way, have an experiment, see how things differ when he's with her, because he didn't know how else to get this information or what was or wasn't normal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's scary to me. You know, I remember, for some reason, loads of my friends love to talk to me about their sex lives. I don't wonder. I think maybe it's having a podcast like this. You're open talking about one thing.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're everyone's go-to for everything. And I'm like, I know a lot of things I don't think I needed to know about my friends. But, you know, it does worry me where young people get the education if it's not from education. And they carry that through with them. It's not, you know, we've started off by talking about young people, but it sets a precedent for a certain amount of shame. If you don't know what's normal, if you don't know how much the variation of human sexuality and biology is normal.
Yeah. Holly McNish, the poet, has mm-hmm. a fantastic short poem about when she was 14 and her friend got a boyfriend, so they were all trying to research how to give a hand job, but they didn't understand, because it was before the internet, they didn't understand that the mechanics wasn't like a
lever.
Yeah, like a lever.
You're doing like an ice cream scoop motion.
So this poor young lad had some young girl manhandling his willy and practically breaking it off because she totally misunderstood. And the punchline in the poem was that I was awful glad it was you that went first. Ouch. You know, there's so much to learn, and it is a learning curve, and with every relationship then it's different because everybody likes different things. But the basics, the basic mechanics, the basic physiological responses and emotional responses are pretty standardised and well understood. And we should be able to help our young people's quality of life by just giving them the information. I just don't see that it should be that complicated.
Yeah, because otherwise we've got a situation like we do now where I feel like our society and our media are more sexualized than ever.
Mm.
And so there's all this pressure that you need to be having it all the time.
Yeah.
And most people aren't. And for a lot of people, that's not really what they want anyway. But yeah. They feel, okay, now me being a normal human is me having sex constantly.
And there seems to be a pressure on them for the type of sex that they're having. So my friend's an A&E consultant, and he's been really concerned about the number of young women that are presenting with anal injuries because there seems to be a sort of hierarchy. See, I sound very old now. Where, vaginal sex is just common or garden. It's not that special. What the young boys, the young, very immature boys, are seen to do is sort of prize anal sex as being better than that. They want to show off to their pals, oh, it took her up the arse. So the couple have consented. So the young woman has consented to vaginal sex, and he tries to slip it in. He doesn't know what he's doing because he's been educated by porn.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody gets hurt in the process. Now, you have to be pretty badly hurt up your bum to take your broken bum to A&E. So how many of these young women are being injured and they're not going to A&E? And there's if you're not consenting to that act, there's a word for that. And I'm not suggesting that these boys are predatory. I think they just need educated. They don't understand what they're doing. They think that it's okay. Now, that's really dangerous. If you're 15 years old and that's how you're behaving, it sets up an expectation that this is normal, and it's really not.
Yeah. And certainly from a mental health perspective, there's no win there.
Mm-mm.
Because it's going to affect your self-esteem either way. You're either going to not be having as much sex or the kind of sex you think you should be having, in which case your self-esteem, particularly I think for young men, is partly tied to that. Or if you are, but you're misinformed, then things aren't happening as You mm-hmm. think they should, mm-hmm. and then that's worrying you.
And then later on in life, once it dawned, like in the light of Me Too, there will be men that think, oh, I did that in my 20s, and actually that wasn't great, mm-hmm. as they've matured and they realise, and, you know, people get better educated, and that has an emotional fallout as well. Once you realise that you did something that was, you know, a crime in law, that has a huge impact. And they're young and horny and not really paying attention because they're thinking with their little head. Generally speaking, that's not the one you make good choices with.
Yeah, no, you're very right. And I think that's where it's all come to a head with the Me Too movement,
mm.
that there is this kind of pressure that to be a man, to mm-hmm. be a genuine male,
mm-hmm.
you need to be able to pull women, mm-hmm. or if not pull whatever gender you're interested in, that's part of you as a person. And realistically, it's not. If you look behind it, there's no kind of, other than procreation, there's no biological justification for that being mm-hmm. tied to your gender identity,
mm-hmm.
but it's all this societal stuff. And so then it doesn't seem to me like a coincidence that then you see men who are in positions of power abusing that power to get sex because they think, oh, well, this is part of maybe being a man, or is this part mm. of me being successful, that I have to be successful in this area as well.
Mm.
It's really scary.
My boys are a bit young at the moment. I've got a 14, nearly 14-year-old and an 11-year-old, but when they're a bit older, I will be doing my very best to make sure that they understand that a night out can end with the sperm staying in their testicles. They don't need to be depositing it all over the place. You can still have a good night out coming home without managing to offload anything. But it's not the ending of an evening. Besides which, they've got two hands. So I'm sure they can fix themselves once they're back in their mammy's house. Yeah, it's...
That's a level of openness of talking about sex that I love about you. I can't think of many mothers that would admit to even that crossing their mind what their boys might be doing.
Come home and have a wank, son. It's there.
You'll be fine.
Can change their own sheets. Yeah. And also things like about when you said about how to treat people, I want my... particularly my sons, to understand that if they do things like domestic chores, if they step up and participate in a relationship and contribute to the way that the household runs, then they get more blowjobs. If that's what they want, that's the way to do it. You behave like a decent person and just tidy up after yourself, and don't treat your partner like they're your mum, expecting to pick up after you and do all of these things. Basic stuff to do with how relationships work. It's about give and take. And if you want to be seen to be a nice, attractive person, empty the dishwasher and get your belly sucked out of it. That's how it works. It's a simple exchange.
Yeah, well, you've reminded me of an ex of mine who used to have this say, luckily not directed at me particularly, but she would say foreplay starts that morning with a kiss on the cheek.
Yes.
That actually for women it's a lot more about the general behaviour.
Yes.
That's what's attractive, mm-hmm. not just,
mm-hmm.
oh, you know, there it is, it's still an okay size. Like, that stuff soon gets a bit more boring, but you being a good person, now that's why people stay in marriages.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I'm delighted to see. There is progress with education reforms around actually talking about relationships,
mm-hmm.
not just talking about sex.
As a function, a mechanical act.
Because then it creates this weird separation.
Mm-hmm.
Where people are like, no, they can be different things. And I don't believe in that. I think whenever you engage with another human, that's a relationship. It may not be a romantic relationship,
yeah.
but there's no way that you have sex that removes it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could go to a prostitute. It's still a transaction. It's still a relationship. You probably speak at some point. We seem to be in this weird time where perhaps partly because of how scientific sex education has been up to now, it does create this kind of, this is biological, it's for reproduction, don't get pregnant unless you want to, try not to catch an STD.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's about, and not the relationship that forms around that.
Sex is just part of being an adult. Having sexual feelings is a normal part of being an adult. It shouldn't be associated with shame. You shouldn't feel guilty for having something that feelings and urges which are normal for mm-hmm. your age group. And once you take away the sort of the giggle factor, it's just a function of your body, like eating or sleeping or exercise or having a poo. It's just something that your body does. So why should it be embarrassing? And because of the hang-ups that people have, the impact these issues can have on intimate relationships, they cause huge disruptions. And people who have got really good relationships, they fall apart because they can't find the words. Because if you don't have the language to be able to describe what is your difficulty is, if you don't know what the bit name of the bits of your body are, if you don't know which bit of it is hurting or which bit of it is itchy or has changed or whatever the symptom is, then you're never ever going to be able to share that information with your partner and ask for help or go and speak to a GP.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I talk about in the show about this awful stat that 50% of women don't know what their vulva is and what their vagina is. How can we be allowing that? That's ludicrous. So the impact from that, apart from like from a sexual function point of view, because vaginas are, you know, a bit numb up there, they're not really that useful from a female sexual response point of view. But when you think about things like vulval cancer, which if you catch it early enough, then has a great success rate, but few of them are caught early enough because women don't look at their own vulvas.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't know what your bits look like, how are you going to know if it's changed? In which case, how are you going to know to take it, to show it to somebody that can help you? It drives me mad. All because female genitalia are shameful and shouldn't be looked at as dirty and keep it tucked away and cover it up. So, I mean, I'm not saying wave it around at a bus stop, but if I was in charge of sorting out sex ed in schools, I would give every young woman a mirror, a sheet of paper, an A4 sheet of paper with a map showing her what the bits of her vulva are,
mm-hmm.
a sample of a range of samples of lube, and homework to go home and figure it out.
Yeah, because with the information, it actually isn't that complicated. In your show, you have a really great way of describing it in that you say, if you don't know the difference, the vulva is the bit you can see and the vagina is what you might be poking around inside. And it's a kind of funny way of phrasing it, and you do it even more animated than that.
I was listening.
And yeah, it just shows you it can be simple and it can be told with a joke, or it doesn't have to be. But 50% of women are never told at any point.
I see women in clinic that don't understand how many openings they have. They're like, you know, talk to women about their anatomy, so you've got your three holes, and they go, what? How can you not know this? You've had children. But how would they know? Nobody's ever told them. Nobody's ever explained to them what normal is. So no wonder they're having really, really crap sex. And because we know that happiness is linked to feelings of worth and intimacy and feeling connected with people, it really matters. You can do an awful lot better.
Yeah, and it's not talked about, and that creates a shame. Because mm-hmm. for some people, they get into a committed relationship and get into a marriage, and a lot of us have this kind of idea that for a lot of people, the sex stops.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be fine too.
Yeah.
But there's always shame around it. You know, the shame if you want it and the shame if you don't.
Yeah.
And then no wonder people's mental health is then affected, because they're trying to put an element of their happiness and their well-being into something that they don't always know that much about the ins and outs of. That's also then all dependent on one other person.
Yeah.
And then what if you break up with them? Well, then you've lost everything.
Yeah. I had a patient once who came because she was leaking, and she was an older woman. She was 84. And
just to clarify for the listeners, when you're referring to leaking, you're talking incontinence.
Yes.
So it's wee as opposed to other things that yes. can leak.
Yes, her problem was wee. And I am very careful to always ask questions about sex, because that's linked with your pelvic floor function. So I said to her, these are questions I ask of everybody. You don't need to answer, but are you sexually active, and does this interfere with that? And she had little half moon glasses, and she pushed them down her nose and said to me, I'm 84, dear. I'm not dead. It's like, oh my God, you're just who I want to be when I grow up. How fantastic. And she was widowed, this woman. but had been buying herself things on Love Honey. She'd found an online shop and she was just having a great time to herself. Good for you. How great is that? She was very happy.
Yeah. And that's the weird thing, that there's such a strange kind of narrative externally about other people's sexualities.
Mm-hmm.
That most people don't want to acknowledge that the kids are doing it as young as they are.
No.
And doing it with no information other than porn, which we know is highly toxic, disproportionately violent, disproportionately derogatory towards women, and all those other fun things.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, on the other end of the spectrum, we're also not acknowledging that older people are having sex. Yeah. And so it's no wonder that then anything that might relate to that, like a lot of the work you do as a vagina physio, is not discussed either, because it's like, oh, but they don't need those parts anymore. It's, yeah. You know, it's not like they need them for weeing or anything.
Yeah, especially that's definitely clear in women. So when a woman becomes menopausal because of the loss of estrogen, it affects the way that her vagina works. And I think, I can't see any reason why you wouldn't just prescribe topical estrogen for women. You can get a little pessary that goes into the vagina and keeps it working more efficiently. If men got to 50 and their willies shriveled up and stopped working, something would be done about it. But because it's just a vagina, this is not routinely prescribed. I don't understand why when a woman gets to 45, she doesn't get a letter from the government saying, these are the things that are likely to happen to your body because of the menopause. If you have these symptoms, these are the treatments that can be given to you. Just, you know, come and seek help. Instead yeah. of which, we allow vaginal atrophy to affect. And it's incredibly itchy and uncomfortable. It stops you from sleeping. So then you're tired and exhausted and belligerent and really cross. Or else they're enduring really painful, uncomfortable sex. When the treatment is really, really cheap, really yeah. works.
Because am I right in thinking it can affect the ability to lubricate as efficiently
yeah.
as well?
Yeah, yeah. And also it's not just the, like, you know, the vagina tissue. It affects the urethra, so the pee tube as well. So then you're more prone to getting urinary tract infections. So that makes you less inclined to want to have penetrative sex because you're going to get a UTI and you're going to be feeling miserable afterwards. So it's just so backwards coming forward. Mm. Medical misogyny is an interesting thing to start thinking about and exploring. But why do we treat these things as if they're irrelevant to women? As soon as they're not of breeding age, then, well, that part of your life
you don't need it anymore, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
And to donate a male example, it's perfectly normal for men in their older age to lose up to an inch of their penis length.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, nobody talks about that. And that you can find that stat in the sex education show. And that's not talked about. In fact, I'll tell you exactly what I thought. I thought to myself, well, I hope everyone else knows that, because there's otherwise going to be generations of guys yeah. around the world that have noticed it's a bit smaller than in their prime. And they've no idea why, and they're not going to talk to anyone about it because, you know, they have this fear that if I go into the doctor's surgery and says, all right, so I think it's a bit shorter, you know, I don't measure it that often, doctor, but I like to do it, you know, every year or so, and I'm pretty confident I wasn't mismeasuring, they'd be worried they're going to be laughed out of the surgery.
But that could be really devastating for some men. Really devastating.
Well, because you're already going through so many body changes anyway as a person growing older that could affect how you feel sexually, how confident you feel about your body.
Is it to do with cardiac disease? Is it to do with loss of blood flow?
It can be.
So there's tissue changes.
Yeah, but it can just be essentially naturally. Shrinkage is the yeah. most common.
Yes, that makes sense, actually. Thinking about when I worked in a nursing home, I was going to say thinking about all the older men's willies that I've seen, but that cast me in a very, very different light. When I worked in nursing homes when I was a student, right enough, thinking about it when I was helping older men get, you know, deal with their hygiene and things, I'd never thought about it, but yes, they do shrink. Amazing.
And then, you know, if you've ever seen a nudist documentary, mm-hmm. all the older men on that would be a good mm-hmm. example, because often they've put on weight as they've got older, yeah. which again can be quite natural as your metabolism ages, but then can also the increased fat tissue can absorb some of your length yeah. as well.
Yep.
And so it can make quite a difference to people. But then again, because as society we've desexualized older people, we don't talk about it because it's like, oh, there's no need for those parts anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A lot of men could feel really emasculated by that. If absolutely. They don't know this is common.
Absolutely. Well, like, you know, if people have testicular cancer, for example, mm-hmm. they usually, it's standard procedure to get a fake mm-hmm. testicle inserted because it helps you feel more normal with your mm-hmm. body. Yeah. It doesn't actually serve any function other than emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
So we're acknowledging it in some places and how it links to mental health, and then others are just overlooked.
And is that because the prevalence of testicular cancer tends to be amongst younger men? It's more common in the younger age group, so maybe it's a bit of ageism.
Perhaps there could be that link as well, that mm-hmm. it is ageism, and they're like, oh, well, they still need theirs to mm-hmm. feel confident about, so make sure they balance.
Interesting. I won't go around measuring my husband's penis and see. He's 50 now, so I'll keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, a bit too late to start a chart at this point, probably.
A reward chart as well. Get a wee star for you. No, I don't think he'd approve of that.
So if there's one thing that I wanted to start wrapping up with, is that I love particularly your message around how there is such variance in what's normal for our bodies in general, and particularly our sexual organs. You have a great line in the show, which I really love, where you keep saying something is common but not normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really great way of putting it, that it's not just you.
Yeah, for sex stuff, you could say it the other way around. It's normal, it's not common.
Yeah.
So whatever your genitals look like, you know, because I see a lot of fannies at work. You know, I've seen an awful lot more vulvas than I really would have for a heterosexual woman deserves. And the question that I get asked a lot by the women is, am I normal? And you're like, well, they're all different. It's just, everybody is different and everybody is normal. If your bits aren't suppurating and stinky and itchy and sore, then yeah, they're probably normal. That you don't have enough to compare yourself with, so people get really anxious in case there's something wrong with them.
Yeah, because the visual side of it is only a small part of the actual function.
There's a really good book series called Bare Reality by a photographer called Laura Dodsworth, mm-hmm. which are like coffee table books of photographs. And she started off with one about breasts, and she interviewed, I think it's 100 women, and took a portrait photograph, but just of their torso. And she asked them about the relationship with their breasts. And then she did one called Manhood. So it's 100 people, and she includes trans people in these photographs. So all different ages, shapes, races mm-hmm. of people that are masculine. And then she's just done one about vulvas called Womanhood. And they're really, really good books that I have got in the house, so my teenagers have all seen them. And I think that kids should get exposed to images of what normal variation is, normal anatomy, instead of on porn, where they think, oh, I'm a freak because I have labia. And
well, that's it, because we've moved beyond a time where we can shield the kids from it.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to see it. Yeah. They're going to seek it out. It's in their pocket on their phone,
you can't stop
a few
it.
Clicks away. So we're sort of, yeah, in a post-porn era in that sense. Yeah. So instead, there must be ways that we can break through with stuff that's more normal. And particularly something we've talked about before on the show a lot is social media and mm. the pressure that puts on people's bodies. And you see all these Kardashians and the like who have had work done, and they're presenting this kind of, I wouldn't even call it perfection, it's like overly perfection. It's unattainable without additional help and filters and the photography team and the makeup and everything else. Mm. And so we've got all this pressure on how we're meant to look on the parts that we show.
Mm-hmm.
But I personally think what's even more dangerous is the pressure on the parts that we don't show.
Yeah.
Because otherwise all you're seeing is porn where certain sizes and shapes are overrepresented, and it's very performative. Mm-hmm. It's all about what these parts look like to a camera, not what these parts actually look like to a human.
And the digital editing that goes on. I have a friend that works for the film board, and she was saying that some of the categorisation, if you can see internal labia, then that goes into a whole different category. So that's why they're missing from porn, because it changes the category of what's the rating thing that changes that?
Like the algorithm, yeah.
That blew my mind. It's just a random rule that somebody's made up. And that means that then you don't see the range of normal represented on the screens. And then you get young girls feeling upset with what they have to the extent that they go and cut them off. You know, there are some women who have labiaplasty because their labia are so elongated that they're interfering with the maiden clothing and they're uncomfortable. But those people are really, really unusual. And the spike in young women referring themselves for labiaplasty, it really is really worrying. And there's a link now in the UK with, or a parallel with it with FGM, mm-hmm. because you're altering somebody's genitals for no good reason.
Yeah. And in the simplest possible way of looking at it, if you struggle to get a referral on the NHS, well, who are you going to go to? It's mm-hmm. the people performing FGM because they're performing outside of that system.
There are women that do benefit from this sort of surgery, but not the doesn't explain the spike in the number of women that are this unhappy with their bodies, and that's a tale as old as time.
Mm. Mm. And so on that slightly sobering note, yes. is there a maybe more upbeat message you'd give if anyone was concerned about what's normal for them, whether that's, you know, their own parts or whether that's leakage, whether that's their sex life? What would you say to them?
Yeah, go and speak to your GP, because whilst it's really, it is difficult and challenging and it can be so embarrassing, but your GP has seen it 1,000 times. You're probably the 20th person in that day with symptoms like that. You'll certainly be the 20th one that week. That, you know, you know when you go to see somebody that's a professional and they say, oh, I've seen this all before. They really have. There is nothing, mm-hmm. you know, I can't think of the last time that I was shocked by a story or an appearance or something in clinic. You really have seen it. You have to be pretty remarkable to be able to bring my poker face.
That sounds yeah. almost like a challenge to get them in.
Yeah.
Bring all your wonky bits to a lay.
But I don't know, piercings and tattoos and then interesting pubic hair arrangements, like none of that you wouldn't even blink at.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So A, the medical professionals have seen it all before.
Yeah.
And B, there's so much help out there.
Yeah, the aim
that
is to
with
try
prevalence
and fix it.
Comes solutions.
Exactly. Yeah.
So there's always going to be something to be done, even if in many cases that's just talking it through and having a professional tell you, you know what, you are normal.
Yeah.
You're well within the normal range.
The value of reassurance, I think, is underestimated, and that's perfectly valid, and then it reduces anxiety, and that is so important for people's emotional well-being.
Absolutely. All right, so we'll finish up there. If people want to learn more about you, where should they go online?
Oh, my website's terrible. I'm trying to update it. It's gussetgrippers.co.uk. And by the end of September, it should be revamped with some proper content on it.
Great. Yeah. And Gusset Grippers is also the name of your show, which is currently here at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Sadly, this episode won't come out in time for that, but
I'm supposed to be going on tour.
Brilliant.
I'm going to tour it, so it'll maybe come to a town near you.
Okay, brilliant. And so you've got social media for Gusset Grippers as
yes.
well?
Yeah.
Grand. All right, so it was so lovely chatting to you.
Brilliant.
Your work is brilliant, and I'm so glad to have talked about particularly a lot of things that feel quite parallel to the work we do. We're trying to reduce the stigma around mental health, but there's so much stigma around people's sex, sexuality, and sex parts,
yeah.
which there doesn't need to be. All right, we'll finish up there. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Bobby. It's been lovely.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.